My name is Milton, and I'm an alcoholic. And I haven't had to drink any whiskey today. For this, I'm real grateful, because a lot of days in my life, I really had to drink. I didn't have any choice. I was in Alcoholics Anonymous for, I suppose, maybe a couple of years, and I didn't really know the difference in wanting to drink and having to drink. For a long time, I had to drink. I'm a member of Traditions Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and my sobriety date is April the 28th, 1973. And I tell you that for two reasons only. One reason is that I heard early on here, if you don't know when your sobriety date is, then you most likely don't have one. And the other reason, if you are perhaps here tonight and you have an idea like I had that I was the world's worst drunk when I got here, that I had been more places and I had done more things and I'd been in more nut wards than any of you. And after you hear me, you'll say, hey, if that guy can do it, I got a chance too. I'll guarantee you. I'd like to thank the committee for asking me, particularly Jim. I've known Jim for a long time and making a visit in their home, and we are close friends. I've been wanting to come for a long time, like my wife said this morning, but it's real close to some other things that we go, and I can only go so much. Now, before I begin, I'd like to ask you one thing. Do you really believe that a guy like me could have done all them things my wife said this morning? I don't believe I've done all them things. Yeah, I've done them, and I've done a lot worse. I took my first drink of alcohol when I was a teenager. Now, there was a lot about alcoholism that I didn't know at this time. I believe I was a full-blown alcoholic then. And this may be only for me, but I believe that alcoholism is a disease, and I believe in my case that it was hereditary. I know my grandfather was an alcoholic. I know my father was. I have a brother who is. Runs in my family, so to speak, like Charles L. from Charlotte says, it runs in my family, always has. I believed here for a long time that I could catch the disease drinking whiskey. I no longer believe that now, and I have the option to believe that. I believe that I either have it or I don't have it. I don't believe I catch it drinking whiskey. I was a country boy from down in Mississippi, and I moved up to Memphis. And when I say country, I mean real country. I was with Bob Duffy down in Mississippi once, and I was near my hometown, my raising ground. And I asked Bob if he wanted to ride home, and he said, yeah, I'll ride with you and me and some more fellas. And we got down to the place I was born, and he said, my God, will we ever get out? Because you see, we didn't have electricity, no running water, an automobile, telephone. We didn't have any of those things. And when my father moved to Memphis, and I had to move up here, my mom and dad moved to Memphis. He took a job with the Railroad Express, and I moved to Memphis. I thought, my God, where am I at? I didn't know how to act. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how to dress. Didn't have any clothes. I can remember my daddy on the way up to Memphis, he made a remark, I've got to get you a haircut. And up until this time, I had, my dad and mom cut my hair. I didn't know what a store-bought haircut was. I really didn't. And we moved to Memphis, and I had to go to one of the bigger high schools there. And I didn't feel in place. I was scared, and I was nervous, and I was worried all the time. I didn't feel like I belonged there. And I was maybe 16 years old, and I had done something one day or one night that I'll always remember. And it's champagne velvet beer. That old CV in a brown bottle. And when I drank that, I could do what I wanted to do. I could talk to them girls, and I could go to school. You know, it just changed me all over. And I liked it. And I remember it was cold and it was wet and it was bitter. And I liked what it done for me. And I was to read years later in the doctor's opinion of our big book, who was written by Dr. Silkworth, who was not an alcoholic but knew a lot about us. And he wrote that men and women drink is essentially because we like the effect produced by alcohol. Now, it doesn't say alcoholics drink for that reason. It says men and women drink essentially for that effect. And that's why I always drink, and I like the effect of it. Always did and always will. Any kind and all kind. Once I drink it, if I could get it down, I like the effect of it. And if I were to leave here tomorrow, and I hope to God I never do, and I would decide to drink, if my insanity were to return, in the beginning, I'd like what it done for me. I could feel it all the way down. I didn't drink much in high school. I don't know the reason that I didn't. You know, maybe not enough money. I had to work, and I just really don't know, you know. But I graduated from high school, and I had to go into the United States Army. And I'm sure there's some here who's been in the Army. And when I was there, I never wanted to do but three things. That's all I ever had any idea of doing, all I ever wanted to do, and that's all I done. One was to gamble, one was to chase women, and the other was to drink. And that's all I wanted to do, and I done it. And I went overseas. I heard Fort Jackson mentioned here last night. And I was at Fort Jackson. I was at Fort Benning, Georgia. And I went overseas to the Far East, and then over there we could, you know, it's awful easy to drink, and I could drink. And I didn't get in lots of trouble, I guess, maybe, you know, a few minor court-martials. But I had one thing on my side in those years, and I see a lot of it represented here tonight. And that one thing was youth. Youth. I was young and I was strong. I could carouse in them honky-tonks, them nightclubs, and wherever I was at. By the next day, I was okay. I could get up and eat some breakfast and shower, and I could go. It wasn't always like that. I in the end, I'd get down drunk. But then I had that youth. I was young. I was strong. And I could do what I wanted to do, and I was most likely, I believe, was an alcoholic. Now, would you have told me this, I'd have said, hey, you crazy. Not me. You may be, but I'm not. I don't want to talk about it because I wouldn't believe it anyway. I came home from the Army, and I was footloose and fancy, free around there for a while. But the thought occurred to me that I might ought to go to work. You know, I might ought to get me a job. You know, I didn't have a wife or anything. I thought I might ought to go to work. I read an ad in the newspaper that they need some policemen downtown Memphis. I went downtown. The old guy said, no, but we need some city firemen. I said, I'll take it. And I went to school. And I did become a city fireman. And I can remember as if it were yesterday, the day 12 and a half years later, that I was dismissed as a direct result of chronic alcoholism. And I can remember having to go home, and I can remember having to face joining the kids. And I went home, and I gathered her and my kids up around me, and I said, honey, I'm not going to drink anymore. I must have quit 100 times. And did you know when I told her that I was not going to drink anymore, I meant that? I believe you meant it when you said it. I never meant to do the things I'd done. I didn't like the consequences of it. I did start to work for the fire department. I had a decent job. I was drinking heavy. But here again, I was young and I could do the things I wanted to do. Was one of the youngest men that was ever promoted to the rank of lieutenant in age of time and service there. Now, once, about a year after I joined the fire department, I was in this beer joint over on Lamar. Now, my wife calls it a drive-in. I call it a beer joint. I don't know what you all call it. You know, nowadays, we got nice names for places like taverns and lounges and honky-tonk, but I called them beer joints because that's what I was there for. I drank beer. And then this little girl was working in there. I don't know what I was in there for. Maybe to get me some beer. I don't know why I was in there. And I asked her for some change, and she kind of squeezed me on the hand. And it's my wife, Joe, and I've been married to her 27 years. And I don't know a lot about Al-Anon, but I know about her. And her lifetime ambition was to get me sober. I got it. I'm here to tell you tonight, if money, if Raising Cane, if psychiatry, doctor bills, ministers, priests, parents, all the authorities, highway patrol, you name it, if they could have got the job done, then we would have made it, we would have made the grave. If I could have bought my way sober, I would have darn sure been sober. I really would have, but we tried. We went to any length. We talked to everybody. You know, always to no avail. Always I would return. Now, I'd quit on occasion because you can't get much in jail. That's about the only reason I would quit. About this time, we had two small children, and we had our own apartment, and I was working for the fire department. And I began to feel some real serious effects of alcoholism. I began to go to hospitals, and I can remember the first hospital I was ever in. It was Old Veterans Hospital in Memphis. I wasn't even 30 years old. And I was in there because I'd been drunk maybe 10 days or 2 weeks, and I'd gotten down drunk. And I was there, and I was in the room, and the doctor came in and left the chart, and when he left the room, I read the chart. He had written on there acute gastritis. I didn't know what gastritis was. I don't know if I know now or not. But what he had written on there, acute alcoholism, it might would have helped. I don't know. And I began to go to Old Gartland Ramsey Hospital, and they'd wire me up for sound in those places. I've been wired up for sound in a lot of them. And I'd be so rummed up when I got out, I'd stop on my home and buy me a bottle of Paragard or some rubbing alcohol and drink. I didn't know what I was doing. I had to have something to drink. And I began to go to a lot of jails. I was convicted of DWI in Memphis and Tennessee and Arkansas all at the same time. Now that isn't a record, but it's a pretty good average, all at the same time. Always with the idea. I drank with the great obsession that most alcoholics drink with. And this obsession is, it will be different next time. I'm not going to jail anymore. I'm not going to lose my driver's license again. I'm not going to wreck my new car. I'm not going to jump on my family. I'm not going to beat Joanne up. It's different this time. I can drink a little bit. I deserve to drink. You know, most of us really believe, or I should say me, I really believe, that after a period of abstinence, that I could drink. That's in the big book, is it not? I believe once I'd have been off of it for 2 weeks or a month, I could drink. I really believe they could. I think it's insanity. And like I said, I began to go to a lot of hospitals. And when I was in those hospitals, I expected them to do one thing for me. And I don't believe they had a chance. I expected psychiatrists to fix me. When I went in a hospital, I wanted them to fix me. I knew I had to pay my money. And I see a lot of people coming out of hospitals today who have been there 30 days or more, and they say, hey, you know, they really believe I'm fixed. But that's what I wanted to do. I used to think in my mind, what was in my mind when I was in those drying out places was, now this place may be all right for all y'all, whoever may be here. But it doesn't apply to me. Now, what I need to do is to get out of here and get my family back together and get my bills paid and get me a job and a car, and then I'll worry about getting sober. I want you to fix me while I'm here where I don't have to drink anymore. I think a lot of people have an idea today. Now, here's my money. You fix me. And it didn't ever work with me. I'd get drunk going home. It didn't work very long. And, you know, psychiatrists always talk to me and always ask me the identical same thing. It didn't matter how many I had or how long I'd been there. They asked me the same thing and told me the same thing, always. And that idea is, you're a pretty good fella. You got a family and you may have a job. You know what your problem is, Milton? You drink too much. Thank God I knew that. That's what I was there for, drinking too much. I wouldn't have eaten ice cream. I didn't know how to stop. Not ever did one of them ever tell me one time, you might ought to try the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was never mentioned. They didn't know anything about it. I lost a lot drinking alcohol. But I believe I lost the most when I lost my self-respect. I completely lost all my self-respect by being an active alcoholic. And I used to stand in front of them old whiskey stores in Memphis, and they always opened at 8 o'clock on the dot. Not ever 1 minute, not never 1 minute after. And I'd be down there about 8 o'clock in the morning, and it was always a long line out in the front. And I might have some change that I'd stole out of my wife's purse or my kid's piggy bank. It's always a man inside. He dusts off the bottles, and you looking at him, and he looks out at you. And I was shamed, and I had a lot of guilt, and I had a lot of remorse. But I wasn't too ashamed to go in at 8:01 with my stolen change, perhaps, because, you see, I knew that if I could make it till 8 o'clock, I could buy me half a pint of dark ice and I could live another half a day. One half a pint of dark ice, I knew it. And there was old Big Star grocery store that was real close to us. And I'd be up there a lot of mornings at 6 in the morning on Sunday morning because, you see, I knew he sold beer. And I maybe have 80 pennies I'd gotten from somewhere. There'd always be a long line behind me up at the checkout counter in the early morning. And I'd get up to the counter, and I'd be scared to death. I'd be miserable. I'd be remorseful. And I felt terrible. When I'd get to the checkout, my hands were sick so bad I couldn't count the pennies. I would ask a clerk to count them because, you see, I knew again. If I could get her to, I could get me a one-quarter stag beer, and I could make it another half a day. Complete loss of self-respect. I guess if it's been in a bottle, I've drank some of it. I've smoked all kind of dope. I could take a pill. Drank everything from the best whiskey to Dr. Titchen's antiseptic, which is hard to drink without a chaser. I drink Paragard, rubbing alcohol. Always with the one idea. Somehow, some way, you'll learn to control your drinking, and you can drink like other people. That was my great obsession, my lifetime ambition, was I wanted to drink like other people drink. I had an idea that I deserved the right to drink. I don't know how that I ever heard of Alcoholics Anonymous. My wife tells me that years ago, way back, that we went to a meeting. I have no recollection of it. I do know that in the early part of 73, I was home, and I was scared to death. And I was walking the floor, and a ring in my hands, crying, yanking at my hair, yanking at my clothes, tearing at my clothes. I didn't know what to do, scared to death. I didn't want to go back to another hospital, or another jail, or another psychiatrist, or another nothing. I wanted to get sober. I wanted to get well. I asked my wife, I said, honey, do you reckon I ought to call AA? And she said, I don't know. We didn't communicate much by this time. And I said, if I were to go, would you call them? And she says, no, if you want them, you call them. And I said, honey, I can't look up a number. And I couldn't. My hand shook so bad I couldn't turn the page to the telephone record. And she said, I'll look up the number. And you call. And I did. And this lady answered the phone, and she asked me the question that we always ask an alcoholic, and I never understood why. If they call up tonight, we'll ask them the same thing. You know what that question is? Are you drinking? We ask them all the time, don't we? And I said, no, ma'am, I'm not right this minute, but the only reason I'm not, I won't stay down. And that's the reason I wasn't. I couldn't get to stay down. And she said, if you'll hold on, it'll be somebody here to see you. And I walked the floor some more. And I wrung my hands and I cried some more. And I called back and she said, hold on. Within about an hour, there's a couple of men walked in my home in Raleigh. I was 12-stepped. I know what these men were about tonight, but I didn't know that night. Here these two men done what I really believe to be the primary thing that we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. The primary factor in the early part of Alcoholics Anonymous is identification. When they walked in my home, one of them was a one-armed man. The other one was a huge fella. When they began to talk to me, I didn't know their names, didn't know where they were from, didn't know a thing about them. But when they began to talk to me, I knew they knew about drinking whiskey. Didn't have no idea what they were, you know, were about, but I knew. Because they told me about themselves, what alcohol had caused them to do, and I could identify. One of them was a one-armed man, and he told me that he had lost his arm as a direct result of getting drunk. The other one had been a bootlegger for years. I had bootlegged some whiskey. I knew they knew what they were talking about. One of them asked me, would I like to go to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous? And I said, you better believe I'd like to go. He said, no. We'll come to your house and pick you up because you probably won't go. You probably wouldn't go. I wonder how many of us do that today. I've been guilty of telling them, I'll meet you down at the club room, or I'll meet you over to group, or I'll call you tomorrow night. He said to me, look, I'll come to your house and get you. We're going to AA. And I knew the guy meant it. So the next night I was ready. And I went to my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was one of the oldest groups in Memphis. Long years of sobriety there. I had the regular chair over there. And they sit back against the wall, a lot of signs around the building everywhere. And I liked it immediately. It was a speaker meeting. The old guy was comical, been sober for a long time. And here again, I could identify with him. When he began to talk and tell me all the things that he had done, now, I didn't know what else he knew. I knew he knew about getting drunk and about wrecking automobiles and about chasing women. I knew he knew that because I'd done some of it. I knew he knew that. And he asked me to come back, and he had a lot of signs around there. And he had signs all over the wall, easy does it. They had one up here on the podium said, we care. And immediately it caught my eye because I was sitting out there, it caught my eye. And I knew they did care. I could tell by the look they did care. One of them asked me if I'd like to buy a big book. I know what the big book was. I knew one thing. Back in those days, I was a real high roller. I'd like to go with the dog track, wreck him new cars, wear them fancy clothes. I had to borrow the money from my wife to buy my used big book. I gave 2.5 for it, and I still have it today. I wish the man who sold it to me would have told me one thing about it that I was to learn later on in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And that one thing that it is our basic textbook. If you could gather up all the information that's ever been written about alcoholism, if you had it on a tape, it's been written, it's been printed, it's been on television, if you could gather it all up, you couldn't get it in this whole room. Everybody, lots of people today is an authority on alcoholism. They know a lot about it, they think. This book right here, it's the basic text of Alcoholics Anonymous. We don't have any other. We don't have any other. And I bought me one that night at my initial meeting, and I was able to read some of it when I got home, and I don't know how. I don't know how, but I was able to read some of it. And I was able to read Dr. Silkworth, where he writes about the doctor's opinion. And he talks about the phenomenon of the craving of alcohol once we have the first one. And I've been around people all my life who could take one drink, didn't even want anymore. But see, when I took one, I could identify with what he was writing about the craving that you begin in my system once I had the one. And I know tonight the only choice I've ever had in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous or all my life about the drink is number one. So I got the choice about tonight. But I've learned from you people, I got that choice. I was able to read Bill's story. And I could identify with Bill. You see, he was a Yankee and he was a stockbroker, and I believe he had some money. And I wasn't any of those, but I could identify with him about his drinking. If you remember where he said that men of finance were jumping off of the buildings of high finance, and he said, I was disgusted, I returned to the bar. And I'd had a lot of problems in my life, and you know what I'd done? I returned to the bottle. Always would. When everything else would fail, the bottle would work. And I could read there is a solution, and I really wanted a solution. Alcohol humbled me. I don't know about you, but it humbled the devil out of me. It had beat me down to a state of reasonableness, I believe the book calls it. I was reasonable. I was willing to listen. I wanted a solution. And in a chapter more about alcoholism, I really could identify here. Because it tells me here we had tried always to stop, and I had. We tried switching brands, drinking only at home, away from home, at work, or away from work. Changing to wine, changing to beer. And I had done all those things. Now, I know you won't believe this because my wife don't believe, but I had my wife convinced one year that if I only drank Schlitz beer, that it would be okay. She really believed that. We used to talk about it, and I believed it too. You know, I drank Schlitz, and we'd just party and cook out in the backyard and drink Schlitz, and she said it's all right. But, you know, it didn't work. Then I could read the fourth chapter, We Agnostics. And I was in Alcoholics Anonymous for well over a year. I didn't know what an agnostic was. I acted like I knew. You know why? All them old timers in my group acted like they knew, and I didn't want to ask them. I didn't want to ask them. I just want to sit on the back row, you know, and want the meeting to hurt me over. And I'd like to urge you here tonight in, you know, all seriousness, if you're new to this program, or even if you aren't new, when you go to your group, your home group, and the older ones there are using terms and ideas and slogans that you don't understand, please don't do like I do. Hold up your hand and ask them. Say, look, I don't understand. Would you please tell me? If they're talking about writing the inventory and you don't know how to write yours, ask them. If they're talking about it, they apparently know about it. Ask them how to do it. I wouldn't do that, you see. I didn't want them to know that I didn't know. So I would just sit on the back row and wonder. And I went back to that group, and I really liked it. Man, I was around there cutting that grass and making that coffee, and they lit me a chair. I believe they even asked me to talk one time. all under 90 days. I don't know what I just said, but they asked me. But anyway, I began to do what my friend Charles L. from Charlotte, North Carolina said he did. You know what I began to do? I began to think. Hey, you ain't so bad. Anybody can drink a little bit. Who's going to know it? I'm not going to tell them about that group over there. My wife's sick in the hospital half the time. I don't know. I don't guess you find out about it. Who's going to tell her? You drink a little beer. You can drink a little beer. You know how long it took me to think myself into a drink? Almost 90 days. I hear people in the program say, I don't believe in slips. I believe in slips. The old age believed in slips. You know where the word slip, where it derived from? It derived from a slip of mind. When I begin to think, and my mind tells me, hey, you ain't so bad, Milton. You can drink a little bit. That's a slip for me. My mind slips. And I did. I began to drink. I bought me a beer one afternoon, joined him to go in the hospital. And I could remember as if it were yesterday. And it really scares me. And this is the reason it scares me. The afternoon that I stopped to buy that can of slits, it was with all the reserve and the firmness in my mind, as clear as it is tonight, that it was okay. It was okay one more time. For me, that's my insanity. I hear people talking here, and they say, I had to be insane because I wrecked my car, and I beat my wife, and I lost my job, and on and on and on. I did those things, but I wasn't insane. I was drunk. I was intoxicated. When my mind will allow me the thought that I can drink, to me that's insanity. You know, the big book has a real clear warning about insanity. Talks about it. Talks about the man who's riding in the country. He's an automobile man like I am. And he's resentful because he's mad because he has to work for a place he once owned. He goes in a restaurant to get his lunch on the pretense of an automobile deal. Now, when he's in the restaurant, the thought comes in his mind right up here. To put an ounce of alcohol into my milk on a full stomach won't hurt me. It won't hurt me, and that's what he does. And he says, is this not insanity? That would be my insanity. That afternoon when my mind allowed me to drink, that's my insanity. Talks about the jaywalker, gets run over 19 times. Ambulance hits him, a fire truck hits him, he picks himself up and he drinks again, or he runs across the street again. Is that not insanity? It was for me. I had to be restored from that insanity. I think that's our second step. The afternoon that I drank that one can of beer, I was off and running within a half an hour. I stopped and bought me another six pack and three pints of whiskey. And I run for two or three days, and I got down for two or three days. And I got home, and by this time, when I was home, I'd graduated from my car into the den, into an old chair. Then I'd graduate on back in the hall, and on back in my old bedroom. And that's where I was. I was back in this bedroom. And I'd been drunk for maybe 10 days. I was scared to death. I had begun to hallucinate. I knew I was on the edge of DTs. Didn't know what to do. I didn't want to go back to another hospital or another nut ward or another jail or another shock treatment. Scared to death. Didn't know what to do. I did the one thing that I had heard the old ones in my group say do. This one thing is, when all else fails, try prayer. And I got down on my knees beside of the of my bed in the urine and the filth of the vomit and said, God, help me. I don't know what I'm going to do, God, but if you got anything for me, please help me. Please help me quit drinking. And that's been over 11 years ago, and I haven't had to drink since that night. Nor have I wanted to drink very much. Haven't had to drink at all. But you see, I done one other thing that night, too, that we all have to do. And if you're an alcoholic as I am, and you don't do it, I don't want to bring you up short, but you plain ain't going to make it. That one thing is I had to surrender. I surrendered that night. Alcohol beat me into a state of reasonableness one more time, and I surrendered. There was no longer any lurking notion in my mind at all that I could drink. I knew if I was going to drink, I was going to die, and it was just that simple. If I was going to drink, I was going to die. And I got up off that floor out of it, urine and filth and vomit, and I was able to sleep some that night. Now, this man who was to be my sponsor a little bit later on, he came by my house every day when I was drunk. He was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, a sober member. He'd bring me some beer in the morning, and he'd bring me some whiskey at night. And his wife would bring me some food. And he told me every day the same thing. And that was, Milton, one day you'll have to get off of it. And when you do, we're going back to the group. And my God, I didn't want to go back to the group. I would rather go on the Alcatraz than back to the group. Because, you see, I let them people down over there. I'd failed them. I really thought that. I was a newcomer, and they used to pat me on the back, and they loved my wife to death, and they said, man, you're doing fine. Man, you're doing great. You're going to make it. He said, we're going back to the group. And when we get there, we're going to use the back row tonight. Now we're going to use the front row tonight. And if you're lucky enough to be called on, you say your name is Milton and that you'd like to get sober because you don't know a damn thing else to say. That's all you know to say. And that's all I did know to say. And I got back in that group. And there were some old timers there. A lot of them are dead now. And I hated them. I didn't like them at all. Didn't like any of them. One of them told me, said, we're glad to see you back, Milton, but we were doing fine while you was gone. But they told me some things that I had to do if I wanted to get sober. And they didn't explain to me there's no must here and all this. And they said, here's what you got to do. If you want what we got, no ifs, ands, and buts about it. We're going to be here, and if you want to get sober, this is what you do. And you know, the first one was so simple, I almost missed it. I see a lot of people miss it today. I see them miss it all the time. Come to the meeting. When we have our meetings, you be here. Now, we don't want to care about you got to work, or you got no clothes, your wife sick, the baby, you know, is in the hospital. When we have our meetings, if you want what we got, you be here. Period. And I was there. And the other one was that you have to be active in Alcoholics Anonymous and you have to have your home group. They told me when you get your home group, you become a part of. I never had been a part of nothing before. Because you see, I was in AA a long time. I don't mean to step on anybody's toes here, but I was in Alcoholics Anonymous for a long time. I've seen people in Memphis. I see them around all the time. And I'd ask them, I'd say, what's your home group? And they'd ask me what mine was, and I'd say, mine's traditions. I was proud of it. And what's your home? Oh, I don't have a home group. I go out to the hospital one night a week, and I go here, I go there, and I go here and talk. Now, what them old timers in my group told me, said, look, you got a responsibility here in your home group. And that means with your money, with your time, with your effort, washing the coffee pot, doing what we tell you to do. Responsibility. I never had any of that in a long time. And the other one is they told me I had to be active in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I had to become a member of AA. See a lot of people around our fellowship today who are here for a little while. They make a few meetings. They're on the fringes. Within 90 days to 6 months, they're gone, and they're gone beyond recall. You never given themselves the opportunity to be active and belong to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I see a lot of them do it, and my heart bleeds for them because they're cheating themselves. They told me, said, look, you've got to become an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and that's how you get sober. And the other one is they told me that I had to do was, I had to, the best of my ability, it was to work with others. Work with others. They didn't tell me I had to be sober 11 years or 9 years or 8 months or what. They said, listen, if you read the big book, there's a place that explains how to make a 12-step call. I asked my sponsor, and he said, no, I'm not going to show you. You find it. And it's in the big book, and it says, any alcoholic properly armed with the facts about himself can win the confidence of another alcoholic. Period. And is that not correct? To me, the key to that, any alcoholic properly armed with the facts about himself, we can identify with another alcoholic. We have the common bond. We can identify with it. I never shall forget my first 12-step call. I went with my sponsor. And man, it was a dilly. It was a girl, and she out there with some Navy man, and he was overseas, and I never heard such a mess in my life. But on the way out there, I asked my sponsor, I said, Harold, I don't know what I'm going to say. And he said, you're not, I am. That's the kind of sponsor I had. He said, I'll do the talking for both of us. And I thought to myself, well, I guess that's okay. I don't want to say no way, you know. And they told me also in that group that my sobriety was by the grace of God. And I believe that tonight. I heard it mentioned here Thursday night in our early bird meeting. The old time AAs, before we had the big book and the steps, used the book of James in their meetings. Here's where faith without works is dead comes from. I take these works, and the ones who I were in the meetings with told me that these works were what I did in Alcoholics Anonymous. It was what I did here, you know, by being active. I think the greatest spiritual thing for me that I've ever read in all my life is the chapter We Agnostics. It's the chapter We Agnostics. And I believe that I was an agnostic because an agnostic requires that you prove God to him. He doesn't really know what he believes, but he requires that you can prove God. You know, the atheist wants you to prove there is no God. The agnostic wants you to prove there is. And I probably was an agnostic because if I had any conception of God, it would be that he was way out here somewhere. And when I died or when I got killed or when I, you know, whatever happened to me, I'd have a little bit of time. And then I was going to talk to him and everything would be all right. Everything would be all right then. I didn't like to think about God, and we didn't talk about him much either. Places I went, you don't talk about God a whole lot. Places like jail, nut ward, you don't talk about it a lot. And I also read in the chapter We Agnostics years later that within each individual is the fundamental idea of God. And I had that fundamental idea because I'd been to Sunday school with my grandmother and my parents way back down in Mississippi, a little country church. I had this fundamental idea of God. Now, you see, when I read the chapter, We Agnostics, it asked me in the very beginning of it, can you ever or have you ever believed in a power who is greater than you are? That's all I'm asked. Can I believe in it? And from this simple beginning, you can grow spiritually. For me, that was a new start. I had a hard time taking the third step. I see some other people having a hard time with the third step. I believe the third step is a new beginning to my spiritual way of living. I can make the decision. I can make the start. I learned that in a chapter, We Agnostics. I went to a meeting once, and I don't even remember where it was, and the chairman said, they're going to have book study tonight. And they're going to study the steps, and they're going to start at the fifth chapter because that's where the steps start. I started to get up and leave. I think the chapter, We Agnostics, is the third step to me. I can make the decision. I can make the new start. And it tells me that there will be a place in my life that I'll be faced by self-imposed crises. That he's everything or he's nothing. And I can remember that happening to me. I was at Pickwick Lake, and it was a beautiful sunshiny morning. I was up there on the tree, much like we have here this weekend. And the guy that was going to chair was the guy that called the drunk monk from Memphis, Florin D. A lot of you may know him. He said, we're going to talk about the third step this morning. I thought, my God, not again. I don't know what to say. I looked out over that lake as he began to hold the meeting, and the sun was coming up over that lake. And I suddenly realized in my life that God is that it. And that he was, that he was everything in my life. And from that place, I began to grow spiritually. You know, that's what spirituality is to me. For a long time, I had spiritual things and organized religion confused. I have no quarrel with church people. You know what the book says about church people? It says we should be quick to see where church people are right. You think there's an awful lot of good people that are in church. I couldn't make it in church. We should be quick to see where church people are right. I began to take the steps, and I began to do what I was told. And I began to get sober. Now, my wife told you this morning that we was asked to start a new group. And if you haven't had that experience, it is an experience. But it was also helpful because when we had to have all the things done that a new group or any group requires, any time that I have the idea that an AA group just happens to be there and that we don't have service work up to the group level, then I don't know what I'm talking about. And we had to have all these things, and we was what we had. You know, we had to be the treasurer and the GR and on, but we didn't have anybody else. And we began to get sober. We began to have a lot of people come there. And it was an experience for all of us. I'm obligated to tell you how it is with me tonight. And that's the part I like. You know, I believe the greatest idea or thing that I ever learned in Alcoholics Anonymous was when I learned to like being sober. I've learned here to like being sober. I like the life I lead today, and I like my sobriety. Without my sobriety, I'm nothing, never was, and never will be. I like being sober. I like the things I do today. I like having my self-respect back. I have a son who's 19 years old. He's sophomore in college. Now, I didn't abuse this kid, but I wasn't close to him because he was scared of me. He never knew how I was going to act. He was arrested with me once. I was arrested, and he was in the car. And I had a Cadillac convertible, and I was carrying a pistol, and I got arrested for it. And the police chased me home, and I ran up in the drive, and they ran me out of the house, and all the neighbors was watching, and awful scene. And this kid was with me. He was scared of me. I could see it in his eye. He didn't know about his daddy, but he knew he loved me, but he was scared of me. He's taller than I am today, and I can talk with him today. He respects his father today, and I respect him, and I can talk to him today. He's no longer afraid of me. He's taller than I am, and I can put my arms around him. He puts his arms around me, and he says, "Daddy, I love you." And I say, "Son, I love you." I can't get any closer to God than that. There's no way. Can't be any more spiritual than that. There's no way. And my daughter, my daughter's 17. My wife talked about it this morning. She is and has been an apple of her father's eye for a long time. She got them little boys, you know, come around, I don't like them, and, you know, just... And she's singing in high school. And the night she was born, I went in the psycho lounge, and it was down on Madison Avenue. Got home 5 days later. Now, you think I meant to do that? I went there and drank a few beers and celebrated the birth of my daughter and gone home like normal people do. Alcoholism. That's what I had and have got. this baby girl and I have always been real close. I don't suppose there's ever been 20 days in her life or my life that she hasn't told me that I love her and I tell her that I love her. I go in her room every night and say, you know, I kiss her and I say, "Baby, I love you." And she said, "Daddy, you know I love you." I can't stand any closer to God than that, no way. There's no way. To me, that's being spiritual. I've heard as long as I've been here, how do I lead this spiritual life? How do I lead this spiritual life? That's okay for you, but how do I do it? We do it by living. We do it by having a faith and a power who is greater than we are. That's all we got. That's all we ask to do. You don't have to prove your faith. You don't have to prove anything to anybody but yourself. You know how spiritual you are. You know how spiritual you are. The program of Alcoholics Anonymous has allowed me to do this and to be that way. I was hopeless and helpless, a chronic alcoholic with no other place to go. And I hope and pray to God that I don't ever have to leave here. I see people here, my sponsor was one of them, who was here sober for some years, left. He hasn't drank, but he left the fellowship. You know what I think that is? Regardless if it's me, you, whoever does it, to me that's a lack of gratitude. I'm no longer grateful for the program that saved my life. And this program literally saved my life. It's been real good being here. I'd like to thank all of you again. I'd like to tell you that I love all of you. And I'd like to tell you and leave you with the thought that for me, everything that I've ever will be, I ever hope to be, and I never have been, I owe it to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you.